wheeled into a small empty space between the booth selling fried dough and the one selling pizza by the slice, and there he did stop, facing away from the milling crowds. When that particular voice came, Norman always listened. It was the voice which had told him 9 years ago that the only way to shut Wendy Yarrow up was to kill her, and it was also the voice which had finally persuaded him to take Rose to the hospital the time she'd broken a rib. "Normie, you've gone crazy," that calm, lucid voice said now. "By the standards of the courtrooms where you've testified thousands of times, you're as nutty as a payday candy bar. You know that, don't you?" Faintly, blowing to him on the breeze off the lake, "Ahoy for terror, matey!" "Normie?" "Yeah," he whispered. He began to massage his aching temples with the tips of his fingers. "Yeah, I guess I do know that." "All right. A person can work with his handicaps, if he's willing to acknowledge them. You have to find out where she is, and that means taking a risk. But you took a risk just coming here, right?" "Yeah," he said. "Yeah, Daddy, I did." "Okay, the bullshit stops here. Listen up, Normie." Norman listened up.
Gert pushed Stan Huggins on the swings for a little while longer, his cries for her to loop him round the loop some more becoming steadily more tiresome. She had no intention of doing that again. The first time he'd damned near fallen out, and for 1 second Gert had been sure she was going to drop dead of a heart attack. Also, her mind had returned to the guy, the bald guy. Did she know him from somewhere? Did she? Could it have been Rosie's husband? Oh, that's insane. Paranoia deluxe. Probably, yeah. Almost certainly. But the idea nibbled. The size looked about right. Although when you were looking at a guy in a wheelchair, it was hard to tell, wasn't it? A man like Rosie's husband would know that, of course. Quit it. You're jumping at shadows. Stan tired of the swings and asked Gert if she'd climb on the jungle gym with him. She smiled and shook her head. "Why not?" he asked, pouting. "Because your old pal Gert hasn't had a jungle gym body since she ditched the diapers and rubber pants," she said. She saw Randy Franklin over by the slide and suddenly made a decision. If she didn't chase this a little, it would drive her nuts. She asked Randy if she'd keep an eye on Stan for a while. The young woman said sure, and Gert called her an angel, which Randy definitely was not, but a little positive reinforcement never hurt anyone. "Where you going, Gert?" Stan asked, clearly disappointed. "Gotta run an errand, big boy. Chase on over there and slide a while with Andrea and Paul." "Sliding's for babies," Stan said morosely, but he went. Gert walked up the path which led from the picnic area to the main drag, and when she got there, she made her way to the entrance booths. There were long lines at both the all-day and the half-day, and she was nearly positive the man she wanted to talk to would not be helpful. She had already seen him in operation. The back door of the all-day booth was open. Gert stood where she was a moment longer, gathering her resolve, and then marched toward it. She had no official capacity at Daughters and Sisters, never had, but she loved Anna, who had helped her out of a relationship with a man who had sent her to the emergency room 9 times when Gert had been between the ages of 16 and 19. Now she was 37, and had been Anna's informal second-in-command for almost 15 years. Teaching battered newcomers what Anna had taught her, that they didn't have to keep going back to abusive husbands and boyfriends and fathers and step-parents, was only one of her functions. She taught self-defense skills, not because they save lives, but because they salvage dignity. She helped Anna plan fundraisers like this one. She worked with Anna's frail and elderly accountant to keep the place on something which resembled a paying basis. And when there was security work to be done, she tried her best to do it. It was in this capacity that she moved forward now, unsnapping the clasp of her handbag as she did so. It was Gert's traveling office. "Beg pardon, sir," she said, leaning in the open back door. "Could I speak to you for a second?" "Customer service booth is to the left of the haunted ship," he said without turning around. "If you have a problem, go there." "You don't understand," Gert said. She took a deep breath and worked to speak evenly. This is a problem only you can help me with. That's $24, the ticket agent said to the young couple on the other side of the window. And six is your change. Enjoy your day. To Gert, still without turning his head. I'm busy here, lady, in case you didn't notice. So if you want to complain about how the games are rigged or something of that nature, you just toddle on down to customer service and... That was it. Gert had no intention of listening to this guy tell her to toddle anywhere, especially not in that insufferable, the world is full of fools voice. Maybe the world was full of fools, but she wasn't one of them, and she knew something this self-important idiot didn't. Peter Slowick had been bitten over 80 times, and it wasn't impossible that the man who had done it was here, right now, looking around for his wife. She stepped into the booth, it was a squeeze, but she made it, and seized the agent by the shoulders of his blue uniform shirt. She turned him around. The name tag on the breast pocket of his shirt said Chris. Chris stared into the dark moon of Gert Kinshaw's face, astonished to be touched by a customer. He opened his mouth, but Gert spoke before he got a chance. Shut up and listen. I think there's a chance that you sold a day pass to a very dangerous man this morning. A murderer, so don't bother telling me how tough your day's been, Chris, because I don't fucking care. Chris looked at her bug-eyed with surprise. Before he could recover either his voice or his attitude, Gert had taken a slightly blurred fax photograph from her oversized purse and shoved it under his eyes. Detective Norman Daniels, who led the drug-busting undercover task force, read the caption beneath. You want security, Chris said. His tone was both injured and apprehensive. Behind him, the man now at the head of the line, he was wearing an idiotic Mr. Magoo hat and a T-shirt reading World's Greatest Grandpa, abruptly raised a video cam and began to shoot, possibly anticipating a confrontation that would land his footage on one of the network reality shows. If I'd known how much fun this was going to be, I never would have hesitated at all, Gert thought. No, I don't want them, not yet anyway. I want you. Please. Just take one good look and tell me, lady, if you knew how many people I see in a single day, think about a guy in a wheelchair, early, before the rush, okay? Big guy, bald. You leaned out of the booth and yelled after him. He came back. He must have forgotten his change or something. A light had gone on in Chris's eyes. No, that wasn't it, he said. He thought he was giving me the right money. I know he did, because it was a 10 and 2 ones. He either forgot the handicapped price of an all-day pass, or he never noticed it. Yeah, Gert thought, just the kind of thing a man who's only pretending to be a cripple might forget, if his mind was on other things. Mr. Magoo, apparently deciding there wasn't going to be a punch-up after all, lowered his video cam. Would you sell me a ticket for me and my grandson, please? He asked through the speaker hole. Hold your water, Chris said. He was an all-around charmer, if Gert ever met one, but this was not the time to offer him helpful hints on how he could upgrade his performance. This was a time for diplomacy. When he turned back to her, looking weary and put upon, she held out the picture again and spoke in a soft, tell-me-oh-wise-one voice. Was this the man in the wheelchair? Imagine him without hair. Oh, lady, come on. He was wearing sunglasses, too. Try. He's dangerous. If there's even a chance he's here, I will have to talk to your security people. Boink. A mistake. She knew it almost at once, but that was still a couple of seconds too late. The flicker in his eyes was brief, but still hard to misunderstand. If she wanted to go to security about some problem that didn't concern him, that was fine. If it did concern him, even tangentially, it wasn't fine. He'd had trouble with security before, maybe, or maybe he'd just been reprimanded about being a short-tempered asshole. In either case, he had decided this whole business was an aggravation he didn't need. It isn't the guy, he said. He'd taken the photo for a closer look. Now he attempted to hand it back. Gert raised her hands with the palms against her chest, above the formidable swell of her bosom, refusing to take it, at least for the time being. "Please," she said, "if he's here, he's looking for a friend of mine, and not because he wants to take her on the Ferris wheel." "Hey," someone shouted from the growing all-day line, "let's go, let's go." There were cries of agreement, and Monsieur World's Greatest Grandpa raised his video cam again. This time he seemed interested only in capturing Gert's new friend, Mr. Congeniality, on tape. Gert saw Chris look at him, saw the color mounting into his cheeks, saw the abortive move to cover the side of his face with his hand like a crook coming out of the county courthouse after his arraignment. Any chance she might have had of finding something out here had now passed. "It's not the guy," Chris snapped. "Completely different. Now get your fat ass out of here, or I'll have you tossed out of the park." "Look who's talking," Gert sniffed. "I could set a 12-course meal on what you're carrying behind you and never drop a single fork down the crack in the middle. Get out, right now." Gert stalked back toward the picnic area, her cheeks flaming. She felt like a fool. How could she have blown that so badly? She tried to tell herself it was the place. Too loud, too confusing, too many people running around like lunatics trying to have fun. But it wasn't the place. She was scared. That's why it had happened. The idea that Rosie's husband might have killed Peter Slowick was bad, but the idea that he might be right here today, masquerading as a paralyzed iron horseman, was 1,000 times worse. She had run into craziness before, but craziness combined with this degree of craft and obsessive determination. Where was Rosie anyhow? Not here. That was all Gert knew for sure. Not here yet, she amended to herself. "I blew it," she muttered aloud, and then remembered what she told almost all the women who came to DNS. "If you know it, own it." All right, she'd own it. That meant peer security was out, at least for the time being. Convincing them might be impossible, and even if she succeeded, it might take too long. She had seen the bald biker in the wheelchair hanging around the picnic, though, talking to several people, most of them women. Lana Klein had even brought him something to eat, ice cream, it had looked like. Gert hurried back to the picnic area, needing to pee now, but ignoring it. She looked for Lana or for any of the women who'd been talking to the bald guy, but it was like looking for a cop. There was never one around when you needed one. And now she really had to go. It was killing her. Why had she drunk so goddamn much iced tea?
Norman rolled slowly back down the amusement park midway and toward the picnic area. The women were still eating, but not for much longer. He could see the first dessert trays being passed. He'd have to move fast if he wanted to act while most of them were still in one place. He wasn't worried, though. The worry had passed. He knew just where to go in order to find one woman alone, one woman he could talk to up close. "Women can't stay away from bathrooms, Normie," his father had once told him. "They're like dogs that can't pass a single damn lilac bush without stopping to squat and piddle." Norman wheeled his chair briskly past the sign reading "To Comfort Stations." "Just one," he thought. "Just one, walking by herself, one who can tell me where Rose is gone if she's not here. If it's San Francisco, I'll follow her there. If it's Tokyo, I'll follow her there. And if it's hell, I'll follow her there. Why not? That's where we're going to end up anyway, and probably keeping house together." He passed through a little grove of ornamental firs and went freewheeling down a mild slope toward a windowless brick building with a door at either end. Men on the right, women on the left. Norman rolled his chair past the door marked "Women" and parked on the far side of the building. This was a very satisfactory location in Norman's view. A narrow strip of bare earth, a line of plastic garbage cans, and a high-stake privacy fence. He got out of the wheelchair and peered around the corner of the building, sliding his head out farther and farther until he could see the path. He felt all right again, calm and settled. His head still ached, but the pain had receded to a dull throb. A pair of women came out of the toy grove, no good. That was the worst thing about his current stakeout position, of course, the way women so often went to the John in pairs. What did they do in there, for Christ's sake? Finger each other? These two went in. Norman could hear them through the nearest vent, laughing and talking about someone named Fred. Fred did this, Fred did that, Fred did the other thing. Apparently Fred was quite the boy. Every time the one doing most of the talking paused for breath, the other one would giggle. A sound so jagged it made Norman feel as if someone were rolling his brain in broken glass the way a baker would roll a donut in sugar. He stood where he was, though, so he could watch the path, and he stood perfectly still, except for his hands, which opened and closed, opened and closed. At last they came out, still talking about Fred and still giggling, walking so close together that their hips brushed and their shoulders touched, and Norman found himself hard put to keep from rushing after them and seizing their slut-whore heads, one head for the palm of each hand, so he could bring them together and shatter them like a couple of pumpkins stuffed full of high explosive. "Don't," he whispered to himself. Sweat ran down his face in large, clear droplets and stood out all over his freshly shaven skull. "Oh, don't. Not now. For Christ's sake, don't lose it now." He was shivering, and his headache had come back full force, pounding like a fist. The bright zigzags boogied and hustled around the edges of his vision, and his nose had begun to leak from the right nostril. The next woman who came into view was alone, and Norman recognized her. White hair on top, ugly varicose veins on the bottom. The woman who'd given him the yogurt pop. "I got a pop for you," he thought, tensing as she started down the concrete path. "I got a pop for you, and if you don't give me the answers I'm looking for, and right away you're apt to find yourself eating every goddamn inch of it." Then someone else came out of the little grove of trees. Norman had seen her too, the fat, nosy bitch in the red jumper, the one who had looked him over when the guy in the booth called him back. Once again, he felt that maddening sense of recognition, like a name that dances impudently on your tongue, darting back every time you try to catch it. Did he know her? If only his head wasn't aching. She still had her oversized purse, the one which looked more like a briefcase, and she was pawing around in it. "What are you looking for, fat girl?" Norman thought. "Couple of Twinkies? Few mallow creams? Maybe a..." And suddenly, just like that, he had it. He'd read about her in the library, in a newspaper article about daughters and sisters. There had been a picture of her crouched down in some asshole karate posture, looking more like a double-wide trailer than Bruce Lee. She was the bitch who had told the reporter men weren't their enemies, but if they hit, we hit back. Gert. He didn't remember the last one, but her first name had been Gert. "Get out of here, Gert," Norman thought at the big black woman in the red jumper. His hands were tightly clenched, the nails digging into his palms. But she didn't. "Lana," she called instead. "Hey, Lana!" The white-haired woman turned, then walked back to Fat Girl, who looked like the fridge in a dress. He watched the white-haired woman named Lana lead old Dirty Gertie back into the trees. Gertie was holding something out to her as they went. It looked like a piece of paper. Norman armed sweat out of his eyes and waited for Lana to finish her confab with Gert and come down to the toilet. On the other side of the grove, in the picnic area, desserts were now being finished up, and when they were gone, the trickle of women coming down here to use the bathroom would become a flood. If his luck didn't change, and change soon, this could turn into a real mess. "Come on, come on," Norman muttered under his breath, and, as if in answer, someone came out of the trees and started down the path. It was neither Gert nor Lana the yogurt pop lady, but it was someone else Norman recognized just the same. One of the whores he'd seen in the garden on the day he'd reconned daughters and sisters. It was the one with the two-tone rock star hair. The bold bitch had even waved at him. "Scared the hell out of me, too," he thought, "but turnabout's fair play, isn't it? Come on now. Just come on down here to Papa." Norman felt himself getting hard, and his headache was entirely gone. He stood as still as a statue, with one eye peeking around the corner of the building, praying that Gert would not pick this particular moment to come back, praying that the girl with the half-green, half-orange hair wouldn't change her mind. No one came out of the trees, and the girl with the fucked-up hair kept approaching. "Ms. Punky Grungy Scumbucket of 1994, come into my parlor," said the spider to the fly. Closer and closer, and now she was reaching out for the door handle, but the door never opened because Norman's hand closed on Cynthia's thin wrist before she could touch the handle. She looked at him, startled, her eyes opening wide. "Come around here," he said, dragging her after him. "Come on around here so I can talk to you. So I can talk to you up close."
Gert
Gert Kinshaw was hurrying for the bathroom, almost running, when, wonder of wonders, she saw the very woman she'd been looking for just ahead. She immediately opened her capacious purse and began hunting for the photograph. "Lana!" she called. "Hey, Lana!" Lana came back up the path. "I'm looking for Kathy Sparks," she said. "Have you seen her?" "Sure, she's throwing horseshoes," Gert said, cocking a thumb back toward the picnic area. "Saw her not 2 minutes ago." "Great!" Lana started in that direction at once. Gert cast one yearning glance at the comfort station, then fell in beside her. She guessed her bladder would hold a little longer. "I thought maybe she'd had one of her panic attacks and just fired on out of here," Lana was saying. "You know how she gets." "Uh-huh." Gert handed Lana the fax photo just before they re-entered the trees. Lana studied it curiously. It was her first look at Norman, because she wasn't a DNS resident. She was a psychiatric social worker who lived in Crescent Heights with her pleasant, non-abusive husband and her three pleasant, non-dysfunctional kids. "Who's this?" Lana asked. Before Gert could answer, Cynthia Smith walked by. As always, even under these circumstances, her weird hair made Gert grin. "Hi, Gert. Love your shirt," Cynthia said smartly. This was not a compliment, but just something the girl said, a little Cynthia-ism. "Thanks, I like your shorts. But I bet if you really tried, you could find a pair that let even more of your cheeks hang out." "Hey, tell me about it," Cynthia said, and went on her way with her small but undeniably cute fanny ticking back and forth like the pendulum of a clock. Lana looked at her with amusement, then turned her attention back to the photo. As she studied it, she absently stroked her long white hair, which she had tied into a ponytail. "Do you know him?" Gert asked. Lana shook her head, but Gert thought she was expressing doubt rather than saying no. "Imagine him without the hair." Lana did better than that. She covered the photo from the hairline up. Then she studied it more closely than ever, her lips moving as if she were reading it rather than looking at it. When she looked up at Gert again, her face was both puzzled and concerned. "I gave a yogurt pop to a guy this morning," she began hesitantly. "He was wearing sunglasses, but..." "He was in a wheelchair," Gert said, and although she knew this was where the work really began, she felt a great weight slip off her shoulders just the same. It was better to know than not to know. Better to be sure. "Yes. Is he dangerous?" "He is, isn't he? I'm here with a couple of women who've been through a great deal of trauma in the last few years. They're pretty delicate. Is there going to be trouble, Gert? I'm asking for them, not me." Gert thought it over carefully before saying, "I think everything's going to be all right. I think the scary part's almost over."
Norman tore off Cynthia's sleeveless blouse, baring her teacup-sized breasts. He clamped one hand over her mouth, simultaneously pinning her to the wall and muzzling her. He rubbed his crotch against hers. He felt her trying to pull back, but of course there was no way she could do that, and that excited him more, how he had her trapped here. But it was only his body that was excited. His mind was floating about 3 feet over his head, watching serenely as Norman leaned forward and clamped his teeth on Miss Punky Grungy's shoulder. He battened on her like a vampire and began drinking her blood when it burst through the skin. It was hot and salty, and when he ejaculated in his pants, he was hardly aware of it, any more than he was aware of her screaming against his hard palm.
"Go on back and hang with your patients until I give you the all clear," Gert told Lana. "And do me a favor, don't mention this to anyone, not yet. Your friends aren't the only women here today who are psychologically delicate." "I know," Gert squeezed her arm. "It'll be fine, I promise." "Okay, you know best."
"Yeah, right, dream on. But I do know he shouldn't be hard to find if he's still cruising around in that wheelchair. If you see him, keep away from him, do you understand? Keep away from him."
Lana looked at her with deep dismay. "What are you going to do?"
"Take a leak before I die of uremic poisoning, then go to the security office and tell them that a man in a wheelchair tried to snatch my purse. We'll go from there, but step one is getting him the hell away from our picnic."
Rosie wasn't here. She might have a date or some other appointment, and Gert had never been so grateful for anything in her life. She was his trigger. With Rosie not around, they had a chance of neutralizing him before he did any damage.
"Do you want me to wait for you while you go to the toilet?"
Lana asked nervously.
"I'll be fine."
Lana frowned at the path leading back through the grove.
"Maybe I'll wait anyway," she said.
Gert smiled. "Okay, this won't take long, believe me."
She had almost reached the comfort station when a sound impinged on her thoughts. Someone panting and hard. No, two someones. A smile curved the corners of Gert's large mouth. Someone was enjoying a little afternoon delight behind the toilets from the sound, just having a nice little, "Talk to me, you bitch." The voice so low it sounded almost like the growl of a dog froze the smile on Gert's lips. "Tell me where she is and do it right now." Gert ran around the side of the squat brick building so fast she barely avoided hitting the abandoned wheelchair and going ass over teakettle. The bald man in the motorcycle jacket, Norman Daniels, was standing with his back to her, holding Cynthia so tightly by her thin upper arms that his thumbs had nearly disappeared into her scant flesh. His face was jammed down against hers, but Gert could see the peculiar cant to Cynthia's nose. She'd seen that before, once in her own mirror. The girl's nose had been broken.
"Tell me where she is, or you'll never have to bother with lipstick again, because I'll bite your fucking kisser right off your face."
Gert stopped thinking then, stopped hearing. She went on autopilot. Two steps took her to where Daniels was. As she took them, she laced the fingers of both hands together to make a cudgel. She raised this over her right shoulder, getting as much height as she could. She wanted all the velocity she could muster. Just before she brought her hands down, Cynthia's terrified eyes shifted to her, and Rosie's husband saw it happen. He was quick, Gert had to give him that. He was terribly quick. Her locked hands caught him and caught him hard, but not on the nape of the neck where she wanted to hit him. He had already started to wheel around, and her hands caught him on the side of his face and the angle of his jaw instead. Her chance for a quick no-fuss, no-muss knockout had passed. As he turned to face her, Gert's first thought was that he had been eating strawberries. He grinned at her with teeth that were still dripping blood. The grin horrified Gert and filled her with the certainty that she had only managed to make sure two women were going to die back here instead of one. This wasn't a man at all. This was Grendel in a motorcycle jacket.
"Why, it's Dirty Gertie," Norman exclaimed. "You want to wrassle, Gertie? Is that what you want? To wrassle? Gonna whip me into submission with those 52 D's of yours, is that what you're gonna do?"
He laughed, patting the flat of one hand against his chest to communicate how tickled he was by the idea. The zippers on his jacket jingled. Gert snatched a glance at Cynthia, who was looking down at herself as if wondering where her shirt had gone.
"Cynthia, run!"
Cynthia gave her a dazed look, took two hesitant steps backward, then simply leaned against the comfort station, as if just the thought of escape had tired her out. Gert could already see bruises rising on her cheeks and forehead like fresh dough.
"Gert, Gert, Bobert," Norman crooned, starting toward her. "Banana, fana, fopert, fee-fi, momert, Gert."
He laughed like a child at this, then armed some of Cynthia's blood off his mouth. Gert could see beads of sweat clinging to his naked skull. They looked like sequins.
"Oh, Gert,"
Norman crooned, and now his upper body began to sway from side to side, like the body of a cobra emerging from a snake charmer's basket.
"Oh, Gertie, I'm gonna roll you like a donut. I'm gonna turn you inside out like a pair of gloves.
And why don't you come on and do it?" she barked at him. "This ain't the high school prom, you chicken shit asshole. If you want me, come and get me."
Daniel stopped weaving and gaped at her, seemingly unable to believe that this tub of guts had shouted at him, had taunted him. Behind him, Cynthia retreated another two or three tired stumble steps, the seat of her shorts whispering against the brick of the comfort station, then leaned against the wall again. Gert cocked her arms and held them out in front of her. The palms of her hands faced each other, about 20 inches apart. Her fingers were splayed. She dropped her head between her shoulders, hulking like a mother bear. Norman observed this defensive posture, and his expression of surprise dissolved into amusement.
"What you gonna do, Gert?" he asked her. "You think you're gonna run some Bruce Lee moves on me? Hey,
I got news for you. He's dead, Gertie. Just like you're gonna be in about 15 seconds, just a fat old nigger bitch lying dead on the ground.
He laughed. Gert suddenly thought of Lana Klein, glancing nervously around and saying that maybe she would wait for Gert to use the bathroom.
Lana!
She screamed at the top of her voice.
He's here! If you're still there, run and get help!
Rosie's husband looked startled again for a moment, then relaxed. His smile resurfaced. He snatched a quick glance over his shoulder to make sure Cynthia was still there, then looked back at Gert. His upper body resumed its back and forth swaying.
"Where's my wife?" he asked. "Tell me that, and maybe I'll only break one of your arms. Hell, I might even let you go."
"She stole my bank card. I want it back, that's all."
"Can't rush him," Gert thought. "He has to come to me. There's no other way I have even a chance of handling him. But just how am I supposed to make him do that?"
Her thoughts turned to Peter Slowick. The parts that had been missing and the places where the concentration of bite marks had been the heaviest, and thought she might know.
"You give the term, eat me, a whole new meaning, don't you, fag boy? Just sucking his cock wasn't enough for you, was it? So what do you say? Are you coming for me, or do women scare you too much?"
The smile did not just slip from his face this time. When she called him a fag boy, it fell off so suddenly that Gert almost heard it shatter like an icicle on the steel toes of his boots. The weaving stopped.
"I'll kill you, you bitch!" Norman screamed and charged.
Gert turned sideways, just as she had when Cynthia charged her on the day Rosie had brought her new picture down to the basement rec room at DNS. She kept her hands lowered longer than she did when she was teaching throw holes to the girls, knowing that not even his blind rage was enough to guarantee her success. This was a powerful man, and if she didn't suck him all the way in, she'd be chewed up like a rat in a threshing machine. Norman reached for her, his lips already peeling back from his teeth, getting ready to bite. Gert tucked even further, her fanny slapping against the brick wall, and thought, "Help me, God." Then she seized both of Norman's thick, hairy wrists. "Don't spoil it by thinking about it," she told herself, and turned back toward him, socking one big hip into his side and then snap-pivoting to her left. Her legs spread, then bunched, and her corduroy jumper never had a chance. It split up the back almost all the way to her waist with a sound like a pine knot exploding in a fireplace. The move worked like a charm. Her hip had become a ball bearing, and Norman went flying helplessly across it, his expression of rage turning to a face full of shock. He crashed head first into the wheelchair. It overturned and landed on top of him.
"Whee!"
Cynthia said in a husky little croak from where she was leaning against the wall. Lana Klein's brown eyes peered cautiously around the side of the building.
"What is it? What are you shouting about?"
She saw the bleeding man trying to crawl out from beneath the overturned wheelchair, saw the bright malevolence in his eyes, and stopped talking.
"Run and get help," Gert snapped at her. "Security, right now, scream your head off."
Norman shoved the wheelchair away. His forehead was only dripping blood, but his nose was gushing like a fountain.
"I'm gonna kill you for that," he whispered.
Gert had no intention of giving him a chance to try. As Lana turned and fled, howling at the top of her lungs, Gert landed on Norman Daniels in a flying drop that Hulk Hogan would have envied. There was a lot of her to drop, 280 pounds at last count, and Norman's efforts to get to his feet ceased at once. His arms collapsed like the legs of a card table that has been asked to hold a truck engine. His already wounded nose slammed into the hard-packed dirt between the brick wall and the fence, and his balls were driven into one of the wheelchair footrests with paralyzing force. He tried to scream. His face certainly looked like the face of a man who is screaming, and produced only a harsh wheezing sound. Now she was sitting on top of him. The jumper's split skirt hiked almost all the way to her hips, and as she sat there, wondering what to do next, she found herself remembering the first two or three times in therapy circle, when Rosie had finally mustered enough courage to speak. The first thing she told them was that she had terrible backaches, backaches that even lying down in a hot bath could sometimes not ease. And when she had told them why, many of the women had nodded in recognition and understanding. Gert had been one of the nodders. Now she reached down and pulled the split skirt higher, revealing a pair of vast blue cotton underpants. Rosie says you're a kidney man, Norman. She says that's because you're one of those shy guys who don't like to leave marks. Also, you like the way she looks when you hit her there, don't you? That sick look. All the color goes out of her face, doesn't it? Even her lips. I know, because I had a boyfriend who was that way. When you see that sick look on her face, it fixes something inside you, doesn't it? At least temporarily. Bitch, he whispered. Yeah, you're a kidney man, sure. I can tell a lot from faces. It's a talent I have. She was using her knees to wriggle her way up his body. She had made it almost to his shoulders. Some guys are leg men, some guys are ass men, some guys are tit men, and then there are some guys, weirded out assholes like you, Norman, who are kidney men. Well, you probably know the old saying. To each her own, said the old maid as she kissed the cow. Off me, he whispered. Rosie's not here, Norm, she said, ignoring him and wriggling a little higher. But she left you a little message from her kidneys, by way of my kidneys. I hope you're ready, because here it comes. She knee-walked one final step, positioned herself over his upturned face, and let go. Ah, sweet relief. At first, Norman didn't appear to realize what was happening. Then understanding came. He screamed and tried to buck her off. Gert felt herself rising and used her buttocks to thump herself back down on top of him. She was surprised he was able to make as much of an effort as he had after the pounding he had taken. No, you don't, me fine bucko, she said, and went on voiding her bladder. He was in no danger of drowning, but she had never seen such revulsion and anger on a human face. And over what? A little hot water. And if anyone in the history of the world had ever needed pissing on, it was this sick Norman gave a vast, inarticulate cry, reached up with both hands, grabbed her forearms, and sank his nails into them. Gert screamed, mostly in surprise, although it did hurt like hell, and shifted her weight backward. He timed her move perfectly, and flung himself up again as she made it, harder than before this time, and succeeded in tipping her over. She went sprawling against the brick wall to her left. Norman stumble-staggered to his feet, his face and bald head running with moisture, his motorcycle jacket dripping with it, the plain white T-shirt beneath the jacket plastered to his body. You pissed on me, you cunt, he wheezed and lunged for her. Cynthia stuck her foot out. Norman tripped over it and went sprawling, face first, into the wheelchair again. He scrambled away from it on his hands and knees, then turned. He tried to get up, almost made it, then fell back, panting, looking at Gert with his bright gray eyes, crazy eyes. Gert started toward him, meaning to put him down and keep him down. She would break his back like a snake if that was what it took, and this was the time to do it, before he found enough strength to get on his feet again. He reached into one of the motorcycle jacket's many pockets, and for one stomach-freezing moment she was sure he had a gun, that he was going to shoot her two or three times in the gut. At least I'll die with an empty bladder, she thought, and stopped where she was. It wasn't a gun, but it was bad enough. He had a taser. Gert knew a crazy homeless woman downtown who had one and used it to kill rats with, the ones so big they thought they were cocker spaniels who just didn't happen to have pedigree papers. You want some of this? Norman asked, still on his knees. He waved the taser back and forth in front of him. You want a little, Gertie? You might as well come and get it, because you're going to get some of it whether you want it or... He trailed off, looking doubtfully toward the corner of the building. Cries of female excitement and dismay drifted from that direction. They were still distant, but they were getting closer. Gert used his moment of distraction to take a step backward, grab the handles of the fallen wheelchair, and jerk it upright. She stepped behind it, the chair's push handles completely lost in her big brown fists. She darted it at him in quick little pushes. Yeah, come on, she said. Come on, kidney man. Come on, chicken shit. Come on, fag boy. You want to zap me? Got your phaser set to stun, do you? Come on, then.
I think we got time for one more tango before the men in the white coat show up to take you away to Sunnydale Acres or wherever they store weird fucks like you.
He got to his feet, glancing again toward the sound of the approaching voices, and Gert thought, what the fuck? I only have one life, let me live it as a blonde, and shoved the wheelchair at him as hard as she could. It struck him dead center, and he went over again with a yell. Gert lunged after him, hearing Cynthia's teary, wavering scream just one instant too late. Look out, Gert, he's still got it! There was a small but vicious crackling sound, zzz, and a bolt of chrome-plated agony shot up from Gert's ankle where he had applied the taser all the way to her hip. The fact that her skin was wet with urine probably made Norman's weapon even more effective. All the muscles in her left leg clenched eye-wateringly tight, then let go completely. Gert spilled to the ground. As she went, she grabbed onto the wrist of the hand with the taser in it and twisted it as hard as she could. Norman howled with pain and kicked out both booted feet. One missed completely, but the heel of the other caught her high up in the diaphragm just below her breasts. The pain was so sudden and so strong that Gert forgot all about her leg, at least temporarily. But she held on to the taser, twisting his wrist until his fingers opened and the nasty gadget fell to the ground. He scrambled back from her, blood bubbling from his mouth and snorting out of his nose in fine droplets. His eyes were wide and disbelieving. The idea that a woman had administered this beating hadn't sunk in, perhaps couldn't sink in. He staggered up, glanced in the direction of the approaching voices. They were very close now. And then fled along the board fence back toward the amusement park. Gert didn't think he would get far before attracting the interest of park security. He looked like an extra from a Friday the 13th movie.
Gert!
Cynthia was crying and attempting to crawl to where Gert lay on her side, watching Norman disappear from view. Gert turned her attention to the girl and saw she'd taken a much worse beating than Gert had thought at first. A bruise like a thundercloud was puffing up over her right eye, and her nose would probably never be the same. Gert struggled to her knees and crawled toward Cynthia. They met and held each other that way, arms locked around necks to keep them from tumbling over. Speaking with enormous effort through her puffy lips, Cynthia said,
I would have thrown him myself, like you taught us, only he took me by surprise.
That's all right, Gert said and kissed her gently on the temple. How bad are you hurt?
No, not coughing up blood. Step in the right direction.
She was trying to smile. It was clearly painful, but she was trying anyway.
Pissed on him?
Yes, I did.
Bitch, God,
Cynthia whispered, and then began to cry again. Gert took her in her arms, and that was how the first group of women, closely followed by a pair of peer security guards, found them. On their knees, between the back of the bathroom and the abandoned, overturned wheelchair, each with her head against the shoulder of the other, clinging together like shipwrecked sailors. Rosie's first blurred impression of the East Side Receiving Hospital emergency room was that everyone from Daughters and Sisters was there. As she crossed the room toward Gert, barely registering the men clustered around her, she saw at least three were missing. Anna, who might still be at the memorial service for her ex-husband, Pam, who was working, and Cynthia. It was this last which most sparked her dread.
Gert, she cried, pushing through the men with barely a glance at them. Gert, where's Cynthia? Is she?
Upstairs. Gert tried to give Rosie a reassuring smile, but it wasn't much of a success. Her eyes were swollen and red with tears. They admitted her, and she's probably going to be here a while, but she'll be okay, Rosie. He beat her up pretty bad, but she'll be okay. Do you know you're wearing a motorcycle helmet? It's sort of cute.
Bill's hands were on the buckle under her chin again, but Rosie was hardly even aware of the helmets being removed. She was looking at Gert, Consuela, Robin, looking for eyes that said she was infected, that she had brought a plague into their previously clean house, looking for the hate.
I'm sorry, she said hoarsely. I'm so sorry for everything.
Why? Robin asked, sounding honestly surprised. You didn't beat Cynthia up. Rosie looked at her uncertainly, then back to Gert. Gert's eyes had shifted, and when Rosie followed them,
She felt a surge of dread. For the first time, she consciously registered the fact that there were cops here as well as women from DNS. Two in plain clothes, three in uniform. Cops. She reached out with a hand that felt numb and grasped Bill's fingers.
"You have to talk to this woman," Gert was telling one of the cops. "Her husband was the one who did this. Rosie, this is Lieutenant Hale."
They were all turning to look at her now, to look at the cop's wife who'd had the deadly impudence to steal her husband's bank card and then try to flee from his life. Norman's brothers, looking at her.
"Ma'am?"
the plainclothes cop named Hale said, and for a moment he sounded so much like Harley Bissington she thought she might scream.
"Steady, Rosie," Bill murmured. "I'm here, and I'm staying here." "Ma'am, what can you tell us about this?"
At least he didn't sound like Harley anymore. That had only been a trick of her mind. Rosie looked out the window toward a freeway entrance ramp. She looked east, the direction from which night would come rising out of the lake not so many hours from now. She bit her lip, then looked back at the cop. She placed her other hand over Bill's and spoke in a husky voice she hardly recognized as her own.
"His name is Norman Daniels," she told Lieutenant Hale.
"You sound like the woman in the painting," she thought. "You sound like Rose Madder."
"He's my husband. He's a police detective. And he's crazy."
Viva Zibul!
He had felt as if he were floating above his own head somehow, but when Dirty Gertie pissed on him, all that changed. Now, instead of feeling like a helium-filled balloon, his head felt like a flat rock which some strong hand had sent skipping across the surface of a lake. He was no longer floating. Now he seemed to be leaping. He still couldn't believe what the fat black bitch had done to him. He knew it, yes, but knowing and believing were sometimes worlds apart, and this was one of those times. It was as if a dark transmutation had occurred, changing him into some new creature, a thing that went skittering helplessly along the surface of perception, allowing him only brief periods of thought and strange, disconnected snatches of experience. He remembered staggering to his feet that last time behind the shithouse, face bleeding from half a dozen cuts and scrapes, his nose stuffed halfway shut, aching all over from repeated confrontations with his own wheelchair, his ribs and guts throbbing from having about 300 pounds of Dirty Gertie perched on top of him. But he could have lived with any of that and more. It was the wetness from her and the smell of her, not just urine but a woman's urine, that made his mind feel as if it were buckling each time it turned back that way. Thinking of what she had done made him want to scream, and it made the world, which he badly needed to stay in touch with if he didn't want to end up behind bars, probably laced into a straitjacket and stuffed full of Thorazine, begin to fuzz out. As he staggered along the fence, he thought, "Get her. Get her. You have to turn around and get her. Get her and kill her for what she did. It's the only way you'll ever be able to sleep again. It's the only way you'll ever be able to think again." Some part of him knew better, though, and instead of getting her, he ran. Probably Dirty Gertie thought it was the sound of approaching people that drove him off, but it wasn't. He ran because his ribs hurt so badly that he could only draw half breaths, at least for the time being, and his stomach ached, and his testicles were throbbing with that deep, desperate pain only men know about. Nor was the pain the only reason he ran. It was what the pain meant. He was afraid that if he took after her again, Dirty Gertie might do better than just fight him to a draw. So he fled, lurching along beside the board fence as fast as he could, and Dirty Gertie's voice chased him like a mocking ghost. "She left you a little message. Her kidneys by way of my kidneys. A little message, Normie. Here it comes." Then one of those skips happened, a short one, the stone of his mind striking the flat surface of reality and flying up and off it again. And when he came back into himself, some little length of time, maybe as short as 15 seconds, maybe as long as 45, had passed. He was running down the midway toward the amusements area, running as thoughtlessly as a cow in a stampede, actually running away from the park exits instead of toward them, running toward the pier, running toward the lake, where it would be child's play to first bottle him up and then bring him down. Meanwhile, his mind shrieked in the voice of his father, the world-class crotch-grabber, and, on at least one memorable hunting trip, world-class cock-gobbler as well. "It was a woman!" Ray Daniels was screaming. "How could you let your clock get cleaned by some cunt, Normie?" He shoved that voice out of his mind. The old man had shouted enough at him while he was alive. Norman was damned if he was going to listen to that same old bullshit now that the old man was dead. He could take care of Gertie, he could take care of Rose, he could take care of all of them. But he had to get away from here in order to do it, and before every security cop in the place was looking for the bald guy with the bloody face. Already, far too many people were gawking, and why not? He stank of piss and looked as if he'd been clawed by a catamount. He turned into an alley, running between the video arcade and the South Seas Adventure Ride, no plan in mind, wanting only to get away from the geeks on the midway, and that was when he won the lottery. The side door of the arcade opened, and someone Norman assumed was a kid came out. It was impossible to tell for sure. He was short like a kid and dressed like a kid. Jeans, Reeboks, Michael McDermott t-shirt, "I love a girl called Rain," it said, whatever the fuck that meant. But his entire head was covered by a rubber mask. It was Ferdinand the Bull. Ferdinand had a big, sappy smile on his face. His horns were decorated with garlands of flowers. Norman never hesitated, simply reached out and snatched the mask off the kid's head. He got a pretty good handful of hair, too, but what the fuck? "Hey!" the kid screamed. With the mask off, he looked about 11 years old. Still, he sounded more outraged than fearful. "Give me that back! That's mine! I want it! What do you think you're..." Norman reached out again, took the kid's face in his hand, and shoved him backward, hard. The side of the South Seas Adventure Ride was canvas, and the kid went billowing through it with his expensive sneakers flying up in the air. "Tell anybody I'll come back and kill you," Norman said into the still billowing canvas. Then he walked rapidly toward the midway, pulling the bull mask down over his head. It stank of rubber and its previous owner's sweaty hair, but neither smell bothered Norman. The thought that the mask would soon also stink of Gertie's piss did. Then his mind took another of those skips, and he disappeared into the ozone for a while. When he came back this time, he was trotting into the parking lot at the end of Press Street, with one hand pushing against his ribcage on the right side, where every breath was now agony. The inside of the mask smelled exactly as he had feared it would, and he pulled it off, gasping gratefully at cool air which didn't stink of piss and pussy. He looked down at the mask and shivered. Something about that vapid, smiling face creeped him out. A bull with a ring through his nose and garlands of posies on his horns. A bull wearing the smile of a creature that has been robbed of something and is too stupid to even know what it is. His first impulse was to throw the goddamn thing away, but he restrained himself. There was the parking lot attendant to think about, and while he would undoubtedly remember a man driving off in a Ferdinand the Bull mask, he might not immediately associate that man with the man the police were shortly going to be asking about. If it bought him a little more time, the mask was worth holding on to. He got behind the wheel of the Tempo, tossed the mask onto the seat, then bent and crossed the ignition wires. When he bent over that way, the smell of piss coming off his shirt was so tart and clear that it made his eyes water. "Rosie says you're a kidney man," he heard Dirty Gertie, the jiggity jig from hell, saying inside his head. He was terribly afraid she'd always be inside his head now. It was as if she had somehow raped him and left him with the fertilized seed of some malformed and freakish child. "You're one of those shy guys who don't like to leave marks." "No," he thought. "No, stop it. Don't think about it." "She left you a little message from her kidneys, by way of my kidneys." And then it had flooded his face, stinking and as hot as a childhood fever. "No!" This time he screamed it aloud and brought his fist down on the padded dashboard. "No, she can't! She can't! She can't do that to me!" He pistoned his fist forward, slamming it into the rearview mirror and knocking it off its post. It struck the windshield and rebounded onto the floor. He lashed out at the windshield itself, hurting his hand, his police academy ring leaving a nest of cracks that looked like an oversized asterisk. He was getting ready to start hammering on the steering wheel when he finally got hold of himself. He looked up and saw the parking lot ticket tucked under the sun visor. He focused on that, working to get himself under control. When he felt he had some, Norman reached into his pocket, took out his cash, and slipped a five from the money clip. Then, steeling himself against the smell, except there was really no way you could defend yourself against it, he pulled the Ferdinand mask back down over his head and drove slowly over to the booth. He leaned out of the window and stared at the parking attendant through the eye holes. He saw the attendant grab for the side of the booth's door with an unsteady hand as he bent forward to take the offered bill, and Norman realized an utterly splendid thing. The guy was drunk. "Viva the bull," the parking lot attendant said, and laughed. "Right," the bull leaning out of the Ford Tempo said. "El Toro Grande. That'll be $250. Keep the change," Norman said, and pulled out. He drove half a block and then pulled over, realizing that if he didn't get the goddamn mask off his head right away, he was going to make things exponentially worse by puking into it. He scrabbled at it, pulling with the panicky fingers of a man who realizes he has a leech stuck on his face. And then everything was gone for a little while. It was another of those skips, with his mind lifting off from the surface of reality like a guided missile. When he came back to himself this time, he was sitting bare-chested behind the steering wheel at a red light. On the far corner of the street, a bank clock flashed the time, 2:07 p.m. He looked around and saw his shirt lying on the floor, along with the rearview mirror and the stolen mask. Dirty Ferdy, looking deflated and oddly out of perspective, stared up at him from blank eyes through which Norman could see the passenger side floor mat. The bull's happy, sappy smile had wrinkled into a somehow knowing grin. But that was all right. At least the goddamn thing was off his head. He turned on the radio, not easy with the knob busted off, but perfectly possible. Oh, yes. It was still tuned to the oldie station, and here were Tommy James and the Shondells singing Hanky Panky. Norman immediately began to sing along. In the next lane, a man who looked like an accountant was sitting behind the wheel of a Camry, looking at Norman with cautious curiosity. At first, Norman couldn't understand what the man was so interested in, and then he remembered that there was blood on his face, most of it crusting now by the feel, and his shirt was off, of course. He'd have to do something about that, and soon. Meanwhile, he leaned over, picked up the mask, slipped one hand into it, and gripped the rubber lips with the tips of his fingers. Then he held it up in the window, moving the mouth with the song, making Ferdinand sing along with Tommy James and the Shondells. He rolled his wrist back and forth, so Ferdinand also appeared to be sort of bopping to the beat. The man who looked like an accountant faced forward again quickly, sat still for a moment, then leaned over and banged down the door lock on the passenger side. Norman grinned. He tossed the mask back on the floor, wiping the hand that had been inside it on his bare chest. He knew how weird he must look, how nuts, but he was damned if he was going to put that pissy shirt back on again. The motorcycle jacket was lying on the seat beside him, and at least that was dry on the inside. Norman put it on and zipped it up to the chin. The light turned green as he was doing it, and the Camry beside him exploded through the intersection like something fired from a gun. Norman also rolled, but more leisurely, singing along with the radio. It made him think of high school. Life had been good back then. No sweet little rose around to fuck everything up, cause all this trouble. Not until his senior year, at least. "Where are you, Rose?" he thought. "Why weren't you at the bitch picnic? Where the fuck are you?" "She's at her own picnic," Zebul whispered, and there was something both alien and knowing in that voice, as if it spoke not in speculation, but with the simple, inarguable knowledge of an oracle. Norman pulled over to the curb, unmindful of the no-parking, loading-zone sign, and snatched the mask up off the floor again, slid it over his hand again. Only this time, he turned it toward himself. He could see his fingers in the empty eye sockets, but the eye sockets seemed to be looking at him anyway. "What do you mean, her own picnic?" he asked hoarsely. His fingers moved, moving the bull's mouth. He couldn't feel them, but he could see them. He supposed the voice he heard was his own voice, but it didn't sound like his voice, and it didn't seem to be coming from his throat. It seemed to be coming out from between those grinning rubber lips. "She likes the way he kisses her," Ferdinand said. "Wouldn't you know it? She likes the way he uses his hands, too. She wants him to do the hanky-panky with her before they have to come back." The bull seemed to sigh, and its rubber head rocked from side to side on Norman's wrist in a strangely cosmopolitan gesture of resignation. But that's what all the women like, isn't it? The hanky-panky, the dirty boogie, all night long. Who? Norman shouted at the mask. Veins stood out at his temples, pulsing. Who's kissing her? Who's feeling her up? And where are they? You tell me.